Welcome to the 48th episode of Cartoon Avatars and the last episode of Cartoon Avatars. I'm your host, Logan Bartlett, and Rashad, it's over. We are now, if people are listening to this, they probably by now know, based on the iconography or the intro or whatever it is, that we are rebranding the show in my ever-ending narcissistic desire for more attention to myself. I decided to name the show after me. We were actually flipping a coin of if it was going to be named after Rashad or myself, and I actually made both sides of the coin me, and so I won.
And yeah, so I said heads or tails, and it was just Logan's face.
Yeah, heads I win, tails you lose. And it turns out it was, yeah, so here we are. But I guess with this is a commitment to do another, whatever, 40, 50 episodes. I think we're going to try to keep going for another year. And so, yeah, I appreciate everyone hanging in there as we sort of try to figure this stuff out, and hopefully this new iteration, new product is something people enjoy.
It's funny, if you look at like successful podcasts, a year in podcast time, even though it feels like we've, you know, been through two name changes and a ton of episodes and guests and bookings and schedulings and all this stuff, but it's really nothing. But what can
by the way, definitely not nothing. Years off our lives,
right?
Yeah.
If I was a listener, I guess a few questions. Why the name change to start with?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of came up with it. It was a derivation of the start with Nikita and Zach, right? And it just didn't really mean anything anymore. And so I don't know. It felt like a more natural name. I sort of felt silly typing it out at times to people, just like, oh yeah, the show, this is the name. It doesn't really, you know, mean anything. And so I don't know. It felt like there was more brand accumulation to be had just by associating myself with it more, and also typing it out. I felt a little less silly. I think those were probably the two main inputs into it. And so hopefully my name will have the recognition with the name. So
yeah,
it actually was. I mean, it wasn't my, when I asked for ideas at the end of the year, someone actually suggested it. And I noodled it, talked it through internally, and everyone was like, yeah, I think that actually makes a lot more sense. So it was actually a pretty easy thing. I was uncomfortable with it at first, but then I realized it probably was the thing that made the most sense. So,
yeah.
I mean, Zach will definitely come back on. At some point, we'll get Nikita. Now that he's sold his company, I think they, as anyone that's read his tweets have seen, he isn't to be wholly trusted behind a microphone at all times. And so I think we need to figure out, maybe let them digest a little bit before he comes on and tells part of the gas story. But yeah, it should be, it'll be interesting. We'll keep having other people on.
Yeah. So we put out 50 episodes to our joke earlier of that not feeling like a lot or it being a lot. And Nikita... what, founded and sold a $15 million business?
I don't know what it was. Was there any rumors of, I know a little bit, but
I read a Twitter thread of like a bunch of people guessing, and all the guesses were between like 25 million and 100 million. So
yeah. You know, who's to say what this is worth? It could be comparable. I don't, you know, equal enterprising. Yeah. He did it. He did that in the amount of time that we've done this. So,
I guess the other question is, like, besides the name change, is there any other changes to the format of the show, in person versus virtual, things you're trying to do more in the next version?
I think it's probably going to be more conversations with people in tech. The biggest consistency I got was, I think people like hearing the news and all that. I found that I only enjoyed part of that. And so I think I enjoy the conversations far more with people. And so I'll do more of those, investors and founders, ideally more founders and people that have had success, but about parts of the journey that they haven't told ad nauseum, I think is ideally the goal. So welcome suggestions. But I think that's probably going to be, not to say we won't hit on topics as they come through. And certainly if crypto ever makes a reappearance into the ecosystem, we'll, I think we'll have to put on the cape and the superhero mask and come in and do that. But for the time being, I think it'll be mostly conversations.
I mean, as a tech podcast with a weekly show, and then something like the SPF thing happens, like you can't release an episode.
Yeah.
At least make a comment on it. So
that will be a universal rule. If there's tens of billions of corporate fraud that occurs within a tech company, we will dedicate at least one episode to talking about it. So that is a promise from here on out.
Right.
So I guess what you're going to hear next is the first episode of the Logan Bartlett Show, the last episode of Cartoon Avatars. A quick plug to everyone, please do like, subscribe, review, all of that stuff, share with friends. We're trying to get the like counts up, particularly on YouTube. So if that's something you could do, we'd really appreciate it. What you're going to hear next is a conversation I have with Peter Reinhardt. Peter was the founder and the CEO of Segment, which he sold to Twilio for $3.2 billion. And now he is the founder and CEO of Charm Industrial, which is in a totally different space, trying to remove carbon from the atmosphere. So we talk about a bunch of different things, but go into how Segment was kind of an accident. We talk about him going to the hospital for panic attacks and all of that. We talk about the state of global warming in some ways, and ESG and all of that stuff. So a really interesting conversation, thoughtful guy, and appreciate him coming on. So you'll hear that now. Peter Reinhardt, thanks for doing this. For people that don't know, Peter was the co-founder and CEO of Segment, sold to Twilio for $3.2 billion in November of 2020. And now the co-founder and CEO of Charm Industrial. We're in your lovely office today, which is a warehouse. And we'll talk a little bit about what Charm does. I think it's different than Segment from what I could tell. But in doing a little bit of prep for this, so you grew up in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Your initial entrepreneurial experience was starting a newspaper.
That's right. Yeah. High school newspaper.
A rogue high school newspaper, right? It wasn't the mainstream one.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It was not the main newspaper for the high school. We sort of started it and distributed it in the hallways.
Was it satirical, or what was the impetus to start your own like ambitious project like that, going after the mainstream media?
I think it was actually my friend Alex Yulee really wanted to do it. And I forget why. Maybe it was more edgy. I don't know. We did the whole thing though. We had crosswords and cartoons, and yeah, it was everything.
That's a pretty, I imagine, decent size undertaking. Actually, getting it physically printed and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Did you think you were going to be an entrepreneur? Was that just something you stumbled into, or do you have like entrepreneurial background in the family or anything?
No entrepreneurial background in the family. Both of my grandpas were ministers.
Interesting. That's different.
Well,
it's a different kind of entrepreneurialism.
Yeah. It's you know, you're preaching.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Great sales.
Oh, yeah.
So you did that. Then you went to MIT. Studied aerospace engineering, so what was aerospace engineering into dropping out and starting Segment?
Yeah, I actually started with the idea that I was going to do physics at MIT, and then it felt a little...
Another easy course load, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, I was really excited for junior lab, which is where you sort of every few months repeat these Nobel Prize winning experiments. I mean, now that they're known how to be done, they're not that hard. But
physics and aerospace engineering, those are like the two known as two of the harder undergrads at Harvard.
They each have these classes that are weeder classes. In Core 16 Aerostro, it is unified engineering. And yeah, you lose half to two-thirds of the class.
And you don't take that to your junior year?
In physics, it's a junior year with junior lab. That's the super hard class. And then for Aerostro, it's a sophomore year.
Interesting. What's the failure rate of each of those classes? Two-thirds is for physics?
I think half to two-thirds for both of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. It was fun.
Yeah. So that's why you dropped out. You couldn't make it.
In my junior year, I felt like the Aerostro program, I mean, what it's designed for is making aerospace engineers who know how to build jet engines and all these kinds of things. And as I started to look at like what that actually meant post-college, it was like, kind of felt like it was going to make me prepared to be GE engineer number 7 working on the latest version of the Black Hawk engine optimizing like 1% to 2%.
It's a narrow career path.
And I was like, you know, it's awesome. I'm glad someone does it, but like... not for me.
And you actually interned at Blue Origin, which, how long ago was this? Was this 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
maybe 17, 18. I was in high school.
Oh, wow.
Turned to Blue Origin. Yeah.
Okay. So this was, I mean, you were early into all this. Now Blue Origin, for those that don't know, Jeff Bezos' space company. I mean, now it's, I guess, still not mainstream, but I don't know, SpaceX and Blue Origin are pretty well known.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you went to that path, and then what took you to Y Combinator, Segment, all that?
Yeah. So I had an experience working at the Naval Postgraduate School on a, it was called the Naval Postgraduate School Solar Cell Array Tester. It was a one unit CubeSat, so 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. And I got to write the flight software for that as an internship. And that was super fun. But it was isolated to that one lab, and all of my experiences outside of that were like, oh my God, government bureaucracy, like big aerospace bureaucracy. I can't handle this. And then in the beginning of, I guess it was junior year, took this class called Founder's Journey at MIT. And it was a really awesome, simple class. Every week, they brought in a new speaker who was a founder, and they just told their story. And it was super inspiring. And one of the sessions, this guy, Adam Smith, who founded a company called Zobni, and he came in and told his story about how he raised $40 million and, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God, like I was totally in awe and like super excited about this guy. And afterwards we were sort of milling around, and my roommate, one of my best friends, Ilya, who later became co-founder at Segment, was like, hey, we should ask him back to the dorm for a beer. And I was like, don't do that. That's embarrassing. Like, he's obviously going to say no, like, just don't embarrass yourself. And he's like, no, I'm going to do it. So he walks over to Adam and he's like, hey, you want to come back to the dorm for the beer? And Adam's like, yeah, sure. So he like came, hung out. We had some beers in our like janky little college dorm room. And it was like such a, I had put Adam on such a pedestal, and he became just such a like real down to earth human. But it was like, wow, this is like an accessible thing. You can just be a person who becomes a founder.
He too likes Bush Lights or Natty Lights or whatever you were passing around. In
yeah.
The
and I mean, Adam is particularly that way.
Yeah.
And an awesome founder. And like, that was totally mind blowing. And I think it was probably around that time that Ilya, Calvin, and I decided like we should start a company together.
So this is junior year and you say, we're going to start a company. And now you go on the hunt for ideas. And like many founders, you start with what you know or what's around you. And so that took you to the classroom, right?
That's right. So we started hacking on classroom software. So initially called Bookzor, which is a horrible name that I came up with, and then Classmetric. And the idea was just like sort of improving feedback loops and building tools for the classroom, since it was really the only thing we knew. And that was what we got into Y Combinator with the next spring. And one of the conditions for Y Combinator in the interview is they're like, are you going to drop out to do this? So we all said yes. And yeah, to our surprise, they let us in. And so we spent the whole summer building Classmetric. The idea was to give students this button to push to say, I'm confused. And the professor would see this graph over time of how confused the students were. We thought it was cool. And then we started deploying it in the classroom, and it was just unmitigated disaster.
Having the laptop up, I imagine people were not
horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Distracted by everything else that's on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember we at some point moved back to Boston, which is where all the universities were. And so that's where we were deploying it. It was like maybe September of 2011. And I remember standing in the back of this classroom at BU, and we were just counting screens of who was doing what. And I think at the beginning of class, it was like 60% of students were doing something off task. And by the end of the class, it was 80%. And like, you'll never really know whether that's just generally the case.
Yeah.
But it made it hyper visible.
The path not taken. People were probably doing that anyway, but yeah. Definitely. Now, one thing just to back up to, the dropout decision is like kind of lionized in Silicon Valley, sort of held on this pedestal. I don't think I've ever invested in a founder that's actually like dropped out and gone down that path. What was that? I mean, you made it whatever, 20 years of your life, you got into MIT, you're going through this aerospace engineering, making that decision where your parents like, you know, WTF, what are you doing here? Or what was that like, the support group around you, was it enabled in MIT that, hey, people had done this in the past and so it wasn't as scary and you can hop back in, or were you scared shitless to do it?
to maybe preface it, MIT was more than just like, hey, I got into a school that I kind of liked. Like, you have to understand that almost every day of high school, I wore an MIT shirt. Like, I was like,
yeah,
I'm going to MIT.
I don't think MIT is many people's safety schools.
Yeah, but it was like really, it was really a big deal for me. And when I didn't get in early, I was decimated, absolutely decimated. So with that kind of backdrop, I think it was kind of a big deal to leave, but I didn't have that much left. I had like a senior project and like, you know, one or two other classes. Like I, from a pragmatic perspective, I had basically done MIT minus a few things, and a senior project, like a company, whatever. These things are kind of interchangeable. So that was kind of my mentality. My parents were supportive, of sort of like whatever I wanted to do, and sort of following my passions. And the key thing is MIT is very gracious about taking leaves of absence. They don't actually let you drop out on a dime.
I imagine that hurts their U.S. News and World Report or something.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. But you take a leave of absence. Yeah. And so technically my leave of absence actually expired last year.
Oh, wow.
So they give you a 10-year window to come back. And as long as you were doing something reasonable, I was like, starting a company is reasonable, you can just come back. So I actually think that, that policy is quite enabling of people to go try interesting things at pretty low risk. So yeah, in some sense, dropping out is high risk, but in another, maybe more pragmatic sense, I actually didn't feel like I was taking a significant risk.
So you get accepted into the Y Combinator. They're like, we like this idea, or we like your guys' background. You're willing to do this. And then the classroom metrics product doesn't have product market fit, quite literally. So what happens then? You see all the screens, and how do you guys raise money at that point? Like, what do you do from there?
Yeah, so we had gotten to demo day. We demonstrated the product. We had a bunch of professors signed up to try it. So I think we raised about $500,000-$600,000 coming out of demo day.
From angels, institutions?
Angels, yeah. And a couple institutional investors like NEA and Learn Capital and stuff like that. I guess now this would be like a pre-seed round or something like that. But it was a seed round at the time. And actually, I was raising that round whilst my co-founders had gone back to Boston, because we were going back there where users were. And I was sleeping on the floor of the Codecademy guys, Zach Sims and Ryan Babinski. And they had just launched Codecademy, and in 3 days had grown to 300 and something thousand users. And so they were like the darling of the batch. And so I was struggling to raise this like $600,000. And Zach was like, you know, meeting Coastlaw on his jet. And like, it was I got so stressed out and like jealous, and like it was frankly horrible for me, self-inflicted, but that I just forgot to eat for 3 days. Eventually, like, you know, went to Chipotle, and some new cook or whatever at Chipotle accidentally made me the largest burrito I've ever seen. And
maybe they just saw you and they're like, this guy needs a major burrito here. Yeah. So Zach's going through that experience. I mean, Y Combinator is such an interesting thing, because the companies I've invested in that go through it, like, you sort of benchmark yourself. You start out benchmarking yourself against your cohort, right? And like the people around you, and then you move to like YC, and then eventually you need to move to like, hey, you know, there's other companies out there in the world to compare yourself against. Yeah. But YC is an amazing batch. I imagine it's motivating in some ways, but also really hard to see, like, you know, you don't have this level of product market fit. Zach's getting flown all around the country and people are probably kissing his ass left and right. Right. Was that like being in that moment, did it make you want to stop and just like, hey, we clearly don't have this figured out, and go back to school? Or did you, what kept you plowing ahead?
I think it was a sense of responsibility to my co-founders that kept me moving forward. Like, we were best friends. We were, I think, more committed to starting a company together and remaining friends through it than we were necessarily to like the idea or anything like that. And so I think I felt a really deep sense of responsibility to Calvin Ilya and Ian and like doing right by them. And I had been entrusted to go fundraise, and I was like, okay, I will find a way to deliver.
So you fundraise on the idea, raise $600,000, and and how long after did you pivot?
Maybe 2 weeks.
Okay. So quick.
Yeah. Literally the money landed, and it was like 5 days later, we were like, we just got back the first results from the classroom, and this is a terrible idea.
You called up the investors and said that?
Yeah, we called back the investors and we were like, hey, we were super upfront about it. Here's what happened. If you want your money back, we'll wire it back. But otherwise, here's what we're going to go do.
What were the points of validation before that? That, like, was it just your own intuition that, like, hey, this idea should work, and professors saying, like, yeah, that sounds good? And then, because it's interesting to go from we can raise 600 grand off of it so quickly to, like, yeah, no, never mind, right? After seeing the kids in the classroom actually use it. So how did those two things jive?
So we had a whole bunch of classrooms signed up to try it.
At
universities that had great logos, right? Like MIT, Stanford, BU. But there was a gap to, like, what actually happens when you put it in the classroom. And so even though there were professors who could be, you know, convinced that it might be a good idea in practice.
Yeah, top-down sale, bottom-up adoption, those can lead to being at odds with one another.
And it was like you have demo day, and then literally a week later, the school year starts. So there's all these artificial boundaries that, like,
interesting. So you had interesting time that actually you could actually go.
If it had been 2 weeks later, we probably wouldn't have raised. This is like bizarre.
It's interesting. Yeah. The road not taken. So 2 weeks, you're like, hey, you can take, you ended up offering some people their money back, right? Or everyone their money back, and some people took it.
We offered everyone their money back. One institutional investor who had committed to LPs to only invest in education had to take it back according to their bylaws. Fine.
Ouch.
And then another angel investor took it back by choice, which is like, nothing against them. It was probably a reasonable choice at the time. I know another investor who I'm good friends with today and is also an investor in Charm. I know wrote it off as a tax loss in that moment. probably the fastest write-off, but he later rediscovered that we were doing well and has been a great friend and supporter.
So then you pivoted to an analytics mixed panel Amplitude, kind of, because that was something else that you knew. You were like, hey, we should have figured this problem out sooner. We should have been able to have analytics on usage and not just survey people in the back of the classroom to see.
That's right. Yeah,
working.
We were like, how janky is this that we have to stand in the back of the classroom to, like, understand what's going on? We should be able to figure this out in a web analytics tool. And so we started building that. And it turns out that's a really tough market. Really, really tough market. Super competitive. I think it's a little bit of like a honeypot idea, where a lot of technical founders kind of find it interesting and sort of migrate towards it. And it's just not actually a great business, nor a big market.
I'll defend my investment in Amplitude. They're doing well as a public company, but it is one of those things. It's almost like salespeople get drawn to, like, BDR automation or something, right? Like everyone sort of has this intuition that, hey, I could do this better. And then they go down the path of doing it. I feel like engineers sometimes with, like, Git or you know, CI/CD, or hey, I can build a better VS Code, or something like that. It's like, if it's so clearly in your face, everyone else is thought of that as well, right? So you guys worked on it for how long?
We worked on it for about a year. Well, a little more than a year, actually.
And did you get paying customers?
We never got a single paying customer for it. I'm not even sure that we actually ever even launched it. We built a lot. We had beta users who were sort of trialing it. And what we found is that we just couldn't find the right fit with it. I think at one point we even ran this experiment where we not only had all the charts and everything that you would expect out of a web analytics tool, but we also went all the way to what we called automatic insights. And so it would go through and look for any statistical anomalies and then draw those out and say, like, oh, well, like, here's what's, you know, here's an interesting insight. And what was fascinating to me is that when people would see it as an automatic insight, they would be like, oh, well, that's obvious. But it's 100% the sort of thing where if you had someone build a narrative around it instead of just presenting it, people would have found it fascinating. And so anyways, we tried a lot. And by the time we got to, like, December 2012, we were like, this isn't going to work. And the stress level that I was carrying at that point, as I think my co-founders was as well, was like, unbelievable. I've never been that stressed. Like, I think I lost like 10 pounds in 2 weeks. I went to the hospital multiple times for panic attacks. Like, I was, my body was reaching wit's end.
And was it just I'm putting forth everything I possibly can into this and I'm getting no positive affirmation?
Yeah,
that
zero.
I'm making, yeah. Any zero. Progress around this.
And the culmination was we were like, okay, we're well and truly stuck. We need to go to YC office hours. And so we went down and had office hours with PG, and we were like walking around the little cul-de-sac there, and he sort of stopped and he's like, yeah, so just to be clear, you've spent $500,000 and you have nothing to show for it. And like that was the
you're low. Like, well, I've been to the hospital twice, so it's a little more than that if you count all those bills. Yeah. Okay. And so you're like, this isn't working. We need to stop. And so then the segment story was what?
So we had a few different ideas that we were arguing about. But my co-founder, Ian, and maybe Calvin, I don't know, one of the other guys, was like, I think there's a big business behind Analytics.js. And so Analytics.js was this small open source library that we'd actually started building a year and a half prior, like at the very beginning of Classmetric. And all it did is it sent the analytics data to both Mixpanel and Google Analytics, and eventually ourselves. That was it. It was like, I don't know, 100, 200, maybe 300 lines of code. Not much to it. And anyways, he had a vision for it. There was like the Analytics.js manifesto that they'd written up. I think we still have a link to the GitHub memo. And so they were kind of pitching this as an idea. And I was like, oh God, this is a terrible idea. How do I kill this? Jesus. And so I like went home and I was like racking my brains. I was talking to Eric about how terrible of an idea this was. And I like went to sleep. I was up all night trying to figure out. I was like, okay, fine. All right. I have an idea of how to kill this thing. Came in the next day and I was like, all right, guys, here's what we're going to do. Let's build a landing page. We'll post that on Hacker News and we'll just like immediately test product market fit. And I was like, this will kill it. And so we did that. And on December 12th, 2012, we posted it up on Hacker News and it went straight to the top. And I think it took us all like thousands of stars on GitHub, thousands of email signups, people reaching out to us on LinkedIn, demanding access to the beta. Like it just on every dimension, it just kind of took off. And weirdly, it was very exciting, but we were all still so depressed from the year and a half of a failure that it took almost like another 6 weeks for us to start to feel positive about it. We had so much downswing momentum.
Well, I imagine some of your co-founders too were like validated by, at least they thought this was a good idea. There was a manifesto out there. Meanwhile, you're like, hey, I had these other two ideas and they were wrong. And then I tried to have this third idea killed and I was wrong, right? So I imagine that was probably a weird feeling too, right?
Totally, yeah. Yeah, I was wrong in both dimensions three times. Yeah, both directions three times. Yeah.
And so I mean, I remember the early days of Segment and it felt from the outside in like you guys just captured this zeitgeist thing that like there was this product market fit. I almost equate it to like, I don't know, Twitter on the consumer side that like, hey, there was just such viral adoption and pull for it. What did you tap into? I mean, clearly the market was there for it, right? But like, what do you think the inputs into that were that allowed you to so deeply resonate in the Valley at the time?
I think the broader marketing technology ecosystem was like taking off at the time. So the number of tools and ideas that people had for what to do with data was exploding. It's like send email, send text messages, like change how ads are displayed in 17 gazillion different ways. Change how your onboarding flow works, like study the data in a data warehouse. Like all of these things were like just coming into fruition as cloud services for the first time. And people were wanting to experiment a lot with these different tools and use, you know, all these different things. And it was just a freaking nightmare to install all that. And then what Segment does to solve that is collect the data once and distribute it to all these different places.
So it enabled the iteration of the nth analytics tool that someone else found the honeypot and decided I'm going to go build a better mixed panel. And it made it easier for people to test out like, okay, well, if you want to do it, we don't have to write this in every single time. Segment can be the canonical source of data for all that. Yeah. And so now you're in this vortex and like the product market fit was there and it just sort of caught like wildfire. And so are you dealing with how much was product evolution and like the different left and right that you needed to go versus just servicing the demand for what you already had in those initial days?
So maybe one thing to clarify is it didn't feel like this, like the product market fit moment was explosive, but after that, it did not feel like it just took off. It didn't take off in like some kind of exponential way, like a Twitter or something like that would in terms of number of people adopting. In fact, if you look at in those early days of like the growth rate of total number of users, it was almost perfectly linear. And I remember PG looked at the graph and he's like, what are you doing to drive this? And I was like, we're not doing anything. He's like, are you sure you're not advertising? Because this looks like you're spending exactly the same amount of money every month, every week. And it's just like perfect line. It's like, no, it's just how it's happening. He's like, I've never seen a line that straight before in my life. Hmm. And so I think in many ways, the story of Segment actually was one of continuous product evolution that increased the value. But the total number of websites adopting it never really accelerated that much. Hmm. So we had pretty linear adoption of sites, but the sites that were adopting it and apps and so on, companies that were adopting it became larger and larger. And the price that they were willing to pay for it went exponential. Like the first pricing plan I think that we offered was like $10 a month or something. And by the end, by the time I left, not by then, still doing great. By the time I left, the highest price points were in the mid seven figures.
And you had to learn how to ask people for money, right? Which is totally. Which is a very different mindset. You build this thing and now you're like, well, I got to go demand people pay. So maybe take through the pricing. I mean, pricing is always a topic with B2B companies in general, but what was the story of walking into Nat's office or whatever it was and demanding higher price?
Yeah, I think Xamarin, Nat Friedman, who later became CEO of GitHub.
Now seems to run Silicon Valley, I guess.
Kinds of things, yeah. Anyways, he was running Xamarin at the time and they were using the product, but I don't think we're paying anything. We're paying like $200 a month or something like that. And we had just brought in the sales advisor because I was clearly struggling to close our first like enterprise contracts. And he's like, the sales advisor was like, Peter, this product is worth at least $50,000 a year. Like you have to charge for that. Probably more like $120,000 a year. So we go to the, he and I are walking over to the Xamarin office. And just before we get to the door, he's like, Peter, in this meeting, you have to ask for $120,000. I was like, come on, man. Like that's crazy. They're currently paying like a minuscule fraction of that. He's like, nope, that's just what enterprise software costs. If you won't ask for it, then I quit. It's like, okay, fine. So we walk into this meeting. It goes great. Nat is really excited about it. He's like, okay, what does it cost to like get the enterprise version or whatever? And I was like, $120,000. I turned beet red. And I was so embarrassed. I was like, didn't know what to do. I was just like sat there quietly. And he's like, okay, well, how about $12,000 a year? And I was like, how about 18? He's like, okay. And like, I was in shock. Because the 18 was whatever that is, 150x what we had been charging before, and to him it was 85% off, and yeah, I was just completely blown away. I was like, "There's like pricing on a different dimension. Like I don't even understand what's going on here." And what I started to learn was the difference, which sounds obvious, between value-based pricing and cost-based pricing. And we were completely in a cost-based mentality, coming from open source and like our own time on these things, and you know, what enterprises pay is based on ROI, is based on value and your demonstration of that value. And so, yeah, over time, it turns out that the product that we had was extremely valuable and it got more and more sort of like exponentially valuable as you get into bigger and bigger companies. Because if you're even Xamarin, you have a website and a mobile app and like a web app or something, you have a few data sources, maybe Salesforce. If you are someplace like Nike, you have like a dozen different mobile apps. You have a dozen different websites. You have point of sale systems. You have a whole bunch of different like sales and marketing tools that are all trying to get interconnected. You have support systems in different countries with like your complexity of data structure has gone completely exponential. And so the value to Nike of solving that problem is drastically higher than it is for a smaller company. And so I think in many ways, the story of Segment was slowly understanding and delivering higher value into these bigger companies and the price increasing over time to support that.
What did you learn through that whole process that is, I don't know, extrapolable for entrepreneurs about the process of like finding product market fit? I've heard you rail on the Airbnb founding story as like maybe destructive to entrepreneurs and how they should actually figure out what's going to make sense in the world, or the Steve Jobs version of all this stuff. But like, what did you learn in that process, and what are some of the lessons that you would say for people that are looking to solve, you know, some
problem? I think the Airbnb story is like a fairy tale basically. Which is like, well, you have your vision of the world and you just stick with it long enough and like great things happen. I'm like, That's a great recipe for just like being broke and lonely in an apartment and like not ever building anything.
That's a fool
by
randomness thing. It's like that survivorship bias of, yeah, they made it, but how many people are crazy?
Great fairy tale, not a methodology.
Yeah.
And by contrast, I think what I've learned is that to pivot quickly, much more like the Codecademy guys, actually. Those guys pivoted 12 times in YC, I think. To pivot very quickly and test the value, and this works particularly well in B2B, less so in consumer, but to really test the value, you go and you try to sell it, right? You go and you try to say like, okay, what would this product be worth to you? Okay, I haven't built it yet, but like, will you sign a contract that if I deliver it, you'll pay $100,000? And like, if you can really like test that value, the process of discovery and sales qualification is effectively the same thing as testing for product market fit. So I actually think sales, or very early sales on the search for product market fit, are actually very tightly intertwined, and is a much more repeatable way of actually finding interesting opportunities.
When you're lost in that journey, how do you keep going, or what are the points of feedback that you remember along the way? I mean, it was kind of nothing, and then like somewhat of a, at least, hey, now we have it, right? But like iterating to get there, the points of validation that you got along the way, was it just, hey, I'm in this with my buddies and we're going to figure this out?
That's right. I don't think we had any real external validation along the way. What was important to us was that we were best friends and working on this thing.
Yeah, interesting. So the segment journey, you grew quickly as you sort of figured out the pricing and all of that. And then ultimately $3.2 billion acquisition by Twilio. Along the way, what any key, I mean, I'm sure hundreds of thousands of key learnings, but anything along the way that was particularly notable that you sort of have brought with you to Charm in terms of process or things you would have done differently through that journey?
Oh boy. I mean, certainly the pricing stuff that we just talked about. I think also sales as a method for actually understanding the customer better. I think it's easy to have this sort of TV vision of sales, which is like the scuzzy salesperson in the used car lot or whatever, who's just like pushy. Like, that's not effective sales. And I think this was maybe best illustrated to me actually by our second sales rep, Chris Surdy. And when we're in the hiring process, like, I was like, we can't hire this guy. It's like slick back hair, jersey. I was like, this guy's going to sell to developers? You got to be fucking kidding me. Like, they're just going to be like allergic reaction, right? And what blew me away was, I mean, the guy crushed his number every year. I think it's top rep basically almost every year, if not every year.
He's going to get a bunch of inbounds on LinkedIn right now.
Yeah, yeah. And like, I clearly did not understand something, right? Like, the performance did not match my expectations. And so I spent time with him traveling around, meeting with customers. And what I noticed was he would ask questions, discovery questions, that were like deeply uncomfortable, from everyone from our side. You know, a customer would be like, oh, well, like, can you tell me a bit more about Segment? He's like, before we get into that, can you tell me why we're here today? And you're just like, that's a little awkward. And the person would be like, well, and they're a little discombobulated. And they're like, well, you know, I guess there's like, we're interested in how to solve our data problems. He's like, why? Like, almost accusatory, you know? And they're like, well, it's, again, taken aback, and then maybe start explaining more. And he's like, but why is that a problem? You know, he's like this challenging, like, five whys, like really unexpectedly deep. And they would basically outline the entire ROI case before we even got started as to like what their actual problem was and how much it was worth to them, maybe not quantitatively, but qualitatively at least. And then the sales process was like kind of a slam dunk after that. And they felt like he actually understood them, because everything that he was talking about after that was directly targeting their actual pain points as opposed to our imagination of their pain points. And so they loved him. And so that concept of like deeper discovery to the point of like awkwardness in the conversation actually being the basis for like a good relationship between the salesperson and the customer was pretty mind-blowing to me. And I think became the basis of what I now think of as how I would search or do search for product market fit, which is much more like a sales discovery motion in that same vein.
And so what was the ultimate decision? So November 2020, the acquisition was announced. I assume you and the Twilio folks had conversations well before then. You stayed on for a little while after, but mm-hmm. that decision is, I'm sure, a very personal one, as well mm-hmm. as there's implications for your co-founders and, you know, families and the entire yeah. company. What was the thought process at that moment in time to, like, this is the right time to exit?
Yeah. I mean, in retrospect, it was, like, you know, great market conditions.
Sure.
But I won't claim any kind of
prescience on that.
The real driver for us was that I had seen the market in a very particular way, which was that the data was going to be the center of everything. That was my view. And that by sort of increasing our data gravity over time, everything would kind of slowly accelerate around Segment. But I saw every customer talk to us about it as their data, as opposed to about how they did their marketing per se, right? These were two separate concepts that needed to be connected on the back end, but were two separate concepts. And when Jeff first chatted with me, I think in 2019, so like a year and a half before the acquisition, he's like, hey, customers want to communicate better with their customers. They want to send better messages. They want to engage with them better. And that's how they're talking about it. And we could build that together, right? With your data and our communication channels, we could actually do the like engagement better. And I was like, I don't think that's the thing. Like, it's really about the data. And if they have the data, they understand they can do all these things. And what happened over the year between that, or the sort of intervening year, was that I saw customers actually start to talk about it that way. They're like, yeah, the data is great, but like, I really want to be able to communicate with my customers. It's not enough to have the data. I actually want to turn it into action. And so, one, that vision became much more appealing. Two, Twilio became a very natural partner in executing on that. And that was the product that then, within Twilio, we launched at Signal, I guess a little over a year ago, of Engage, which is like tying these two things together that way. So that vision was very appealing. You know, COVID was also like brutal. We'd just done a riff, like, so it was the right strategic decision for the company. After the acquisition closed, Segment was accelerated dramatically on the sales side, which I think is entirely due to the Segment sales leadership, Joe Morrissey, who's now a GP at Andreessen, and Katrina Wong, who's on the marketing side and still at Twilio.
What, as you're sort of weighing those options, the constituents you have in mind, obviously there's your employees, your co-founders, yep. your shareholders, all of that. Are you trying to balance, and then at a personal level, like, yep. you know, you're no longer going to get to be the only one that calls the shots in the way that you are when you're an independent standalone CEO, right? Board governance and all that included. But how did you sort of think through? Were you just sort of equally weighing all of them together? Do you have a North Star on, hey, one person, you know, one group versus another?
I put a lot of weight on the team.
Does that mean company or co-founders or both?
Both.
Yeah.
But really, like, I mean, co-founders sort of second to the rest of the team. I'll give an example of that in a second. I do think I also, like, personally, I knew that I didn't want to stay in software forever. Like, the reason that I had gotten into software in the first place was that, like, I want to start started a company with my roommates, right? And we, like, wanted to work together. And I don't know that they were long for it at that point. I think they wanted to do other things. And so my motivation of being, like, tied to these people was also diminished. And like, I knew eventually I wanted to get back into hardware. Like, that was where I started in aerospace, and like something about the tangibility, you know, like here, out on the floor where like we build stuff, and I like got into the field, and there's like, you know, bio oil flowing underground, which we haven't gotten to yet, but like the tangibility of what's happening is really meaningful to me in like my day-to-day motivation. And at Segment, it's like a meta analytics data layer that like exists in the cloud, and like, you know, electrons are flowing somewhere. And so I do think there's a very personal component here that I don't want to discount. But in how we went about doing it, I am very proud of actually of how much emphasis we put on the team. And not just in the negotiation of it, but also in things that we did like 8 years prior. So when we were in maybe 2015 or so, we changed the option exercise window to basically be the maximum allowable, which is somewhat common now, was not common at all at the time.
What is maximum allowable? 10 years?
I think it's 10 years, yeah. And that one decision of changing the exercise window, I think changed the economic outcome for several hundred people from nothing to millionaires. And like to be able to see that outcome for all these people who were not even, it's mattered for the people who weren't at the company anymore, but who had been very involved and critical in the early stages of building the company and making it all possible. So to see them have like a significant life outcome from it was super, super meaningful. And anyway, there's like a handful, half dozen things like that, that we really fought for in how it all played out over the full 10-year arc of the company. And I'm super proud of that.
Yeah. I appreciate you talking about the personal side of it, because from the outside in, I had no knowledge of it, but I kind of got the feeling like Segment was so strategically valuable, right? Like I was an investor in Pendo and Amplitude and Braze, and the number of board meetings I had talking about Segment in some way, shape, or form, you know, it's like, it's a very important partner. And also to all those, you know, to a bunch of people, it could be a potential competitor, right? Mm-hmm. And so,
we always had an option call on going from the data up into any of the communications.
Yeah, you could go from the infrastructure to the application, right? Yeah. And you know, and so it's very strategic real estate that you could go do interesting stuff with. And so it was interesting from as someone that appreciates you know, competitive dynamics and all that stuff. It both felt like it made so much strategic sense for Twilio. Mm-hmm. It was certainly in retrospect an amazing valuation and outcome for that. But I also kind of got the feeling that you, and now we can talk about this, but had bigger ambitions than being B2B software and just, you know, being the king of the Segment as a $20 billion public company. And so it's I appreciate you saying that, because I've heard, you know, people can want to go after other ambitious things right along the way. You don't have to stay a B2B software investor or a B2B software entrepreneur. So was Charm in the back of your mind as like, hey, I want to do something in climate tech, or like what was rattling around your brain at the exact moment?
Yeah, I mean, the Charm story starts in 2015, actually. So in 2015, I tried to buy offsets for Segment. And
maybe explain offsets, what that means.
Yeah, carbon offsets. So this is like, you know, I emit by buying electricity, and I want to make sure that that has no net impact in terms of CO2 emitted. So I buy an offset that theoretically removes some CO2 from the atmosphere. Now, it turns out in practice, basically all offsets are garbage. And so in 2015 and 16, that's what I learned. And so we went and bought a bunch of offsets. And then I was like, what the heck happened here? And then it turned out like, oh geez, like nothing, maybe it had good ecosystem effects. It was like protected forest in Brazil and Indonesia, whatever. Great. Proud of those ecosystem impacts, but like carbon impact, not so clear.
And so, and you're doing this, like the concept of an offset, you're doing this to be net neutral, that your footprint that you're making by doing whatever it is you're doing as a business is neutral to the atmosphere. Yeah. And you're doing this as a good corporate steward, someone that believes that not just profit, it's not financially, purely financially motivated for most companies.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think you can make arguments around employer branding and other things if you want, but I also think it's just like the right thing to do.
Yes. And so you start going down this path 2015, 16, hey, Segment, you probably don't have as big of a carbon footprint as a industrial manufacturer, but you still are flying salespeople around the country, you still are powering electricity, all that stuff. And so how do we offset this in some way? And so you effectively bought some rainforest and protected that area.
Yeah. And the question is like, okay, if you take oil out of the ground and you burn it and you put it in the atmosphere for the next 500,000 years, right? That CO2 is not coming out. So it's out there now. And then you protect a tree for 40 years, have you really undone what you just did by burning it? No, the answer is no. So,
And by the way, the in 2016, are there companies that you're able to go through to do this? Like, who are you interfacing with?
There are. It turns out in retrospect, when you go back and, you know, like Berkeley Carbon Trading Group has done an analysis as well. Now a formal like academic analysis of what's the quality of those, like 95 to 99% are just worthless from a carbon impact perspective. And so that was the feeling that I got when I went and inspected these things more closely, but it's now backed up by the literature as well. And so basically I was like, uh-oh, there's no good product here. This is a problem. So I started as a buyer. And then in 2016, I was like, you know, this will get solved when Clinton is elected. That's naive on like six different levels, but we know how that election went. And so in 2017, I was like, well, I wonder if there's a profitable way to do this. So,
and by the way, 2016, it would be solved because the government would, like, what did you think was actually going to happen from the government?
They would regulate, like, auditing and quality that would ensure that these things
became... It wasn't just going to be bullshit on the back end.
Yeah, exactly. Again, naive on, like, a lot of different levels. Technically, politically, et cetera. But in 2017, then, I spent every Saturday... with some friends trying to figure out if there was a profitable pathway to sequester carbon and ideally drive industrial decarbonization, because now I was starting to learn that, like, you know, electrifying car transport looks like it's on a pretty good path. Electrifying the grid looks like it's on a pretty good path, at least technologically, like huge amounts of deployment yet to come. But like largely we kind of see what the solution is going to look like. Industrial decarbonization, we have no idea. No idea. Like there are a half dozen at best companies making a legitimate shot on goal for decarbonizing steel production. It's 8% of global emissions. If we don't figure it out, like we have to figure it out.
Your Tesla is not going to matter if we can't figure out all this.
Yeah. And there has only ever been 100 tons of fossil free steel delivered ever. It just like, it just has not been, it's not a solved problem.
What percentage? I mean,
out of 3 billion tons per year, we have one company delivered 100 tons last year. There will be zero deliveries this year.
Yeah.
Zero deliveries next year. There are forecasted to be deliveries, I believe, starting in 2026.
Got it. So drop in the bucket.
Yeah, nothing.
So you're spending your quite literally nights and weekends. How big of a company? So Segment, you sold in 2020, you had about 600 people. And so this is as you have hundreds of people, your Saturdays are kind of spent just exploring
this.
It was
like on the ramp from 150 to 600.
150 to 600. Yeah. And so you're figuring this out and also running a company. And so what did you find during that journey besides that there was a lot of bullshit and no one was making tangible progress?
What we found was a very specific pathway that we got pretty excited about at the end of 2017, which was to take waste biomass, so like this corn stover, which is like the straw and leaves of corn.
These aren't spices.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
So take that corn stover, that corn straw, and cook it. And when you sort of cook it, you get out some effectively fossil fuel replacement, which we'll get more into in a minute. And you get out char, which is like a charcoal. It's this stuff right here.
Yep.
Sort of a black powder with ash and stuff, nutrients. So that goes back in the soil and you get at least some short-term carbon storage. And then you decarbonize the industrial process. And so we're like, great, this is a super cool pathway. We're going to get at least some short-term carbon removal and or carbon sequestration, and we'll decarbonize an industrial process at the same time.
And so I'm sorry, forgive my simple B2B software investor brain, but so you're doing that, and how does that actually get the carbon out of the atmosphere?
So the CO2 comes from the atmosphere into the plant.
Yep.
As the plant is growing.
Yep.
Then some of that carbon ends up in this
somewhat
solid form of char and goes into the soil. And then the rest of it comes out, now it comes out as bio oil, this liquid stuff. And it then can go be used as fossil fuel replacement in industrial processes like iron making or what have you downstream. So you decarbonize the industrial process and you end up with some carbon that would have just rotted and returned to the atmosphere that's now stored for a longer period of time. That was the original idea.
And what did you learn?
What we learned about 2 years in is that it was not economical to transport the biomass to the industrial facility. And so this is like a, we're getting a little into the weeds here, but like the technicality was like, oh shit, we just can't, you can't physically transport the biomass far enough, cheaply enough to make this whole thing pencil.
And it wasn't one of those things that, hey, with scale or over time, it's going to work. You, the lines just didn't cross at some point in the future.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, you could just see it. It's just like never gonna pencil. And so that was a crisis. That was, I believe, in end of 2019. And my co-founder, Sean, had two breakthroughs. His first breakthrough was that rather than just producing char and a syngas, which we didn't really talk about, that was sort of the fossil fuel replacement, we could shift the process and produce this liquid bio oil on site. So at the field edge, we would convert it into the biomass into these two, the solid char, which goes back on the field, and the liquid, which then is highly transportable. So now we have a dense, carbon-rich, somewhat energy poor, but fluid that's easy to transport by truck or rail. This solves the economic problem because you don't transport the low density, hard to move biomass, and you just transport this super dense liquid. So all of a sudden the economics start working in the long run. The problem is now the short run, where like we don't have a premium enough buyer, right? And this is where the product market fit stuff that we were talking about before of like, how do you find someone who's willing to pay a good price for it? We didn't have someone who was willing to pay a high enough price to get us started for this industrial decarbonization pathway. And this is where Sean had his second breakthrough. So he was trying to figure out, we had made some bio oil and he was trying to figure out how to dispose of it. And I thought this was like a little bit of an unnecessary goose chase. And I was like, come on, can we just focus on the problem here of like, who's going to buy the bio oil at what price? And he's like, no, we've made a gallon. It's proper to dispose of these things properly. So I'm going to go research it. Okay, fine. So he goes off and he comes back like a week or two later. He's like, okay, we can either dispose of it in, a disposal well, like injected underground, or we can have it flared and incinerated. And I was like, again, I don't care. Whatever works. And then the next day, I think he comes back. He's like, if we put it underground in an injection well, isn't that carbon removal? Because the CO2 came out of the atmosphere into the plant, into the bio oil, and ends up permanently underground. Like, doesn't Stripe have an RFP for carbon removal? Payments company? Yeah. All right, let's run the model. See how expensive it is. Holy smokes, it's cheaper than direct air capture, like the best sort of carbon removal option known at the time. It's like, okay. So we applied to Stripe in their very first round of RFPs, and they made a purchase. And it was like a $250,000 purchase, turned it around in like 96 hours or something like that. And we're sort of like, had this major discovery of like, oh wow, there's a premium market that's willing to pay for the really high carbon value of the bio.
And who is that? Who's willing to pay for the high value carbon?
Basically the carbon offset, full circle back to the carbon offsets market.
Got it.
Right? Because like when you pump this stuff underground, it's gone, it's permanent, and it's super verifiable.
Yeah.
And that's worth a premium. And so that's what Stripe and then later Shopify and then later Microsoft were willing to pay for. And so basically, and as we were going through this transformation, Segment was also going through its sale. And so about halfway through 2021, it was like taking off. And I was like, okay, like how will I judge myself, you know, if I like don't go see through a like totally major potential solution for decarbonizing industry and carbon removal if I don't see this through.
Yeah. Well, I imagine I'm doing a little bit of math, but you left in, you sold in November, you left in summer of 2021. So you probably...
No, I left in January of 22.
22. Okay. Yeah. I was doing some vesting schedule type stuff, but I imagine this was a, probably staying at Segment would have, probably was a financially lucrative path as well.
That's
but
correct.
This was more of a mission and passion to go do it. And so today, the market as it stands, so you talked about there's Shopify, there's Stripe, there's Microsoft, there's people that are doing this to be good corporate stewards, right? And that's one market. And I assume that's a pretty big market. It sounds like people are willing to pay a fair amount for that. But how do you sort of break up the segments? And there's the kind of carbon offset grid, you know, all the government aspect of it. So what are the different market aspects here?
Yeah, we split our go-to-market into three motions. There's the most premium market segment, which is voluntary carbon removals. These are corporate buyers, like we just talked about. That will help us come down the cost curve into the regulatory market segment. This is regulated markets where it's still corporate buyers, but they're required to buy. some form of offset. Like the low carbon fuel standard in California, for example, creates effectively a cap and trade system. Or there's the 45Q tax credit, which basically just now does a direct pay for if you put carbon underground, you can get paid for that. So that's the regulatory market.
And those are mostly like industrial manufacturers. It's anyone that the government has said, hey, you need to do this. You're putting a big carbon footprint out there.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a very small proportion of the economy today, but presumably will grow. I think there are other interesting forces at work. A huge number of companies have made net zero commitments now, which is that they, by some period in, by 2030 or 2040, 2050, will remove as much carbon from the atmosphere as they are emitting. And those, you know, that means that there will be sort of increasing buyers over time as they run through their reductions first, which is great. And then they'll start to need removals to deal with some of the remaining hard to abate sectors. For example, flying people around, that kind of thing. And investors, I think, are on Wall Street now are very dialed in on when a company makes a net zero commitment, are they actually standing by it? And like, that's important for how people have decided to allocate towards, you know, ESG funds and so on. And so there's a lot of pressure for, because people are investing on the basis of some of these environmental claims and emissions claims, for the SEC to create a little bit more regulation and clarity around, okay, if you make a net zero commitment, how are you doing that accounting, right? What are your emissions? If people are investing on the basis of these emissions, then there need to be some standards. And so the SEC is, I think, working towards a world where the accounting is more standardized. And I think that that will create clarity and raise the bar for the quality of removals that people are buying to offset some of these things. So I think the voluntary market will get substantially larger, and over time, the regulatory markets will get substantially larger. All of that has accelerated dramatically in the last 2 years. The third market for us really is the iron making market. So we can use the bio oil to make iron and make it fossil free. Out of that process, we also still get a CO2 stream that can be pumped underground. And so we still get the carbon removal benefit.
Very circular.
Why we're excited about
this whole process is there's one element of at least one of the pushbacks I've heard from people is like, hey, well, there's other countries that are emitting a ton and aren't doing anything about it. Can you put that in relative terms for people with the implications of, hey, well, if China doesn't do this or if Russia doesn't do this, then aren't we just kind of yelling into the clouds by ourselves? What is that?
I don't think it's very grounded in data. If you look at the pace of solar deployment and solar production, not only solar production, which of course they're exporting some of, but most of China's solar production is actually for domestic use. And I believe that they have deployed more solar now than anyone else in the world, and maybe even more than the rest of the world combined. Like, it is enormous amount of internal deployment of renewable energy and so on in India as well. So I'm not sure that narrative actually fits the data.
Even zooming out, like the state of play from a Gantt chart timeline standpoint, right? If we're looking out, where are we in a process and enablement to get to where we need to be with the impact of all the stuff that's going on today?
The carbon removal ecosystem is incredibly nascent, or I should say the supply side, at least, is incredibly nascent. In the last 2 years, we've seen a total volume of deliveries of carbon removal of about maybe 6,000 or so tons. And that compares to 50 billion tons per year of emissions. And by 2050, we need, according to most of the IPCC analysis, we need about 10 billion tons a year of removal. So we need to go from 6,000 tons over the past 2 years to 10 billion tons per year by 2050. It's about 70% compound growth for the next 27 years. So that's what's required from a climate perspective. And so the growth of the industry that is going to have to happen is staggering. Like, it will be a challenge to build that much completely new industrial infrastructure. Steelmaking is in an even crazier position, right? Like I was saying before, there's 100 tons of fossil-free steel has ever been made out of 3 billion tons a year. We need to get that to zero by 2040, 2050 as well.
And why are those dates picked, 2040, 2050? What is the...
These are just scenarios modeled by the IPCC. there's a lot of flexible points in how these scenarios are modeled, but these are sort of like the most reasonable models.
Yeah. And so your process as it stands today, how far along the way at full capacity can that take us to?
Yeah. So what I mentioned of those 6,000 tons that have been delivered, Charm delivered 5,500. So
high market share.
Yeah. So far we've delivered about 90%. And hopefully it will become a bit more of a moon race here in the next few years. I think there are, big oil and gas companies that are building carbon capture facilities in the Permian and in Texas. Climeworks is an awesome direct air capture company in Iceland that's building their next 10x scale up. So I'm hopeful that there'll be a lot more activity here, but we're racing as fast as we can to scale up over the next decade or so. I think the total sort of cap for our North America operations is probably about 1 billion tons a year, just based on biomass availability. There's an enormous amount of injection, like rock capacity to accept injection, but the biomass availability, waste biomass availability, is going to be our rate limiter. So probably about roughly 1 billion tons in North America will be kind of our limit. And then we look at other operating theaters like India has a lot of biomass and agricultural residue and injection kind of capacity. Brazil, same thing. Potentially sort of Central Africa around Nigeria, both oil and gas producing and large amounts of biomass. So those are kind of like maybe Australia. Those are kind of like the major operating regions that we look at. And I think it probably caps out around like 5 to 10 billion tons.
Okay. So you can get close-ish. If you could wave your hands today, like I assume one of the things you'd want are more entrepreneurs going after, I guess, what are the limiters in the market today, and what are the big changes that you would see? Is it government? Is it entrepreneurs? Is it funding? Is it more corporate buy-in? What are the big kind of limiters that you would wave your magic wand and kind of change?
We definitely need more mechanical engineering talent in going into climate and carbon removal specifically.
Why is that?
These are really hard mechanical engineering problems, right? Of like, how do you design and deploy what is effectively, if you take all of the industrial infrastructure that we've deployed over the last 100 years, we have to redeploy that in the next 25.
Yeah.
A staggering amount of hardware engineering that has to happen to do that. And so there's going to have to be a wholesale transition of either generating new mechanical engineering and hardware talent or transition from other places like oil and gas. But regardless, it's a staggering amount of infrastructure that has to be built. I think the other is certainly more government support and longer term contracts helps us draw then more investment in and make all these hires and so on. So it can kind of never go too fast on the demand side. And certainly we need more corporate buyers entering the space. The Stripe, as the first sort of RFP in the space, has now morphed into what's called Frontier Climate, which is an advanced market commitment. They've raised about $1 billion to purchase carbon removal. But that's a drop in the bucket. We're going to have to be buying something like $100 billion a year by 2050. So, $1 billion over 10 years needs to grow by whatever that is, three orders of magnitude. So we need more.
Stripe leading the way on this, or Shopify or Microsoft, is... what is unique about those companies that they've been the ones to be out in front on this? Is it coming from, I assume it's not customer. I mean, they all sort of service same customers as other businesses that don't do this. Is it the employees? Is it just the leadership at the top? Is it some combination of the latter two?
I think there's a key constraint, which is they all have relatively small footprints.
Yeah, I guess mostly planes and electricity, right?
Yeah, probably an easier. Like if you're in a big industrial company, your footprint is too big to play with these kind of premiums. So, they have relatively small footprints, like profitability or close to it. They have cash flow to sort of play with these things.
Yeah, good businesses.
Yeah, great businesses. Financial services is probably another category that I think is going to start making moves in carbon removal purchases in the near future, or has started already. The other thing I do think is leadership at the top that recognize that this is going to have to happen. And they can play a catalytic role in helping get it off the ground with like a relatively small amount of money in the scheme of things. And I think cultures that have a rigor of an analytical rigor to identify that actually most of these carbon offsets are not doing anything. Two, that we really need these super high quality carbon removal processes like bio-oil sequestration or direct air capture or enhanced weathering or ocean alkalinity enhancement. I think that kind of, and I guess the foresight to see the trends that are happening and say, wow, by 2030, we might be required to be net zero, right? I mean, that's hard to imagine now, but like 6 years ago, it would have been impossible to imagine that people would even be spending this amount of money on carbon removal. So like flow forward another 7 years, if we're all required to buy carbon removal to be like at least on the march towards net zero, there literally won't be enough capacity. So if you're a really smart buyer, you start getting close to the suppliers to be first in line to buy that capacity. And I think there's a lot of strategic early mover relationship building and supply chain building that's happening as well.
So is that the big case? I guess if you were making the case right now, the sales pitch to whatever Adyen that competes against Stripe or I don't know, Big Commerce that competes against Shopify or whoever it is. What are the cases that you make to them to do it now rather than like, because the economy's worse than it was 6 months ago or a year ago, right? And so people are being asked more about their bottom line and spending more on, you know, cost cutting and RIFs and all of that stuff. And so as you make these sales pitches to companies, like is that one of the big ones, is hey, this might be an inevitability and so get in line now? Is it hey, you have a bigger purpose than just pure financial profit now? Like, what are some of the things that you tell, you know, sitting across the table from a leadership of another company?
I mean, we certainly walk through our capacity. I mean, again, Charm is like, we started deliveries 2 years ago, 2 years, 3 days ago, and no one else has started deliveries yet.
Yeah.
Or at least claimed any deliveries yet. So, it's a severely capacity constrained market. Like if you wanted to buy at whatever premium 50,000 tons this year, it doesn't exist. So like Charm is sold out through 2025 or so. And with new contracts we're supplying, that will continue to get pushed out. So if you're a company that's thinking like, oh, you know, I'd like to start like making a net zero commitment and start to do something, like you're already multiple years behind. Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, other companies that are maybe starting to build or prototype, like I pretty much guarantee they're not going to have capacity before then either. So as that timeline starts pushing out, yeah, that's certainly, if you intend to buy this in the future, then like it is so supply constrained, that I think smart buyers are jumping on it faster. There's also a key thing on price here, which is,
I was about to ask about pricing. 'Cause I mean, if supply demand, like you could probably, I know you won't do this, but you could probably charge exorbitant amount for this for the people that want to cut the line, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, probably won't do that. But the what we do with our prices, we have what's called the most favored nation clause. So we everyone pays the same price. Currently, it's $600 a ton, and when we lower our price in the future, everyone will get dragged to that new price. But the people who committed earliest at the highest price point will get an additional kicker. Proportion delivery below that.
Mm.
So it's actually, you get the best price by committing now, which is very helpful to us because then the committed contract allows us to go do cheaper fundraising and not only of equity, but also of debt and so on to actually finance building these machines.
ESG as a term has become, I don't know, politicized or loaded. What's your view on that as a, I guess, as a term? Is it the right branding? Does it need rebranding? Because of, it seems to also mean a bunch of things and also mean nothing, back to your point about like, you know, the nature-based offsets and some of those things. What's your perspective on that?
I mean, first, it's an acronym, I forget, for environmental, social, and governance.
Governance, I think.
And everyone kind of keys on the first word, which is environmental. And they're like, oh, well, this is about companies that are doing environmentally good.
Yeah.
But I think actually that when you look at the detail at the criteria are much more evenly distributed across those three things. And the bar in environmental is not actually that high. And so what that means is that oil and gas companies lean very heavily into doing a lot by those criteria on the S and G side, in particular on the governance side, I think, and just like end up scoring very highly. And you look at this thing that you're sort of keyed on environmental, and then you look at the score of an oil and gas company, and you're like, this can't be right.
Yeah.
And it's not right as compared to what people have in their head as to what it's measuring, right? So I think relative to expectations, the ESG criteria are pretty off base. You know, in managing our own capital, like personally, like we don't use the indexes. We have gone to greater lengths to like figure out how to invest in the companies that we think are actually having a positive impact on the environment. But yeah, there's a huge disconnect between what people think those criteria mean and how they're actually measured.
Now, what sort of taking a step back between your two experiences to date, like what have you learned, commonalities and interesting differences? And I mean, I'm sure there's an infinite number of them, but as you sort of compare Segment to Charm and hardware to software and B2B versus, I mean, I guess you're still B2B, but B2B offsets as the case may be. Are there any particularly interesting kind of things that stand out in your current experience versus your former one?
There's a lot that's the same. You know, if you go through like finance, HR, recruiting, sales, marketing, like a lot of it is the same.
Yep.
The most fun difference for me is that when we get to share pictures of what we do, it's like really cool stuff happening in the field. You know, it's like gritty. There's like actual people doing, you know, like real things out in these physical operations. Maybe a more interesting kind of like strategic shift for me has been like software development versus hardware development. Two things are obviously different, but some of the ways in which you can accelerate each of them are like not as you would expect. So in software, for example, if you want to go faster, you like ship more frequently, right? You're just like, okay, we're going to get down to like all the continuous integration, continuous deployment, like we'll ship hundreds of times per day. Great. Works super well. We'll add all these unit tests and everything. This just like fundamentally does not work in hardware because you have shipping times. You order a component. It takes like at least overnight for it to get there. And then it takes you like a little bit of time to do some kind of basic quality control integration, like you just like physically cannot move around this material as fast as you can with code. And so what happens is, and for more specialized parts, you end up with lead times of months or weeks. And so you just literally can't ship incrementally like that. And so what it leads to is, well, you would still like to pack more learning into the same period. So how do you do it? Well, one way is to parallelize. So we end up with, at different times, a lot of parallelization in different places. Where, for example, we are parallel tracking, purchasing waste bio-oil that we inject so we can learn about the subsurface. We're parallel tracking that to buying off-the-shelf pyrolyzers that make bio-oil so that we can practice 24/7 operations, practice biomass supply chain, practice hiring operators, maintenance, training, insurance, all kinds of stuff. And we're parallel tracking, designing and building our own pyrolyzers to come down the cost curve. And so by parallel tracking these three things, we don't have to wait for like our own machine to be sufficiently good enough to generate the bio oil, to learn about the 24/7 operations, to have enough bio oil to test out the injection for the first time. And so we end up with a lot of parallelism in different places that, you know, we try to pinch off and narrow the choices eventually. But that sort of parallelism, I think, is a new motion and sort of, I guess, unique as to how to accelerate hardware.
Yeah. It's fascinating, the process related. I mean, we're sort of coming back to the old original manufacturing, lean manufacturing and all that stuff back in the day. But we've gone so far down the software rabbit hole of optimizing those things that when you take a step back in the venture landscape, has there been an uptick that you've seen of people interested in hardware since you've kind of gone into this? And have you had more outreach for entrepreneurs trying to learn how to go about it, investors that are interested in investing in the space? Has that changed notably since you started down this path?
For sure. I think in 2018, the watershed moment was the IPCC report that showed that we were going to overshoot and needed, you know, 10 billion tons of removal by 2050. So that was a watershed moment, I think, for a bunch of people of getting into the space. I think that's when Stripe kind of started doing their thing. That's when Charm started, et cetera. I think also, obviously the collapse of software technology valuations in the last couple of years, or year or so has obviously made people pick up their heads and kind of look around. So I think that those two things of
software has become a little less appealing and climate has become a lot more urgent, and sort of raised its profile. And I think the balance of those two things has caused a lot of interest in getting into climate. I think people feel a lot more purpose.
Are you optimistic about the next 5 years in this space, and then where we're going to go over the next till 2050? Are you pessimistic because there's not the sense of urgency there needs to be? What's sort of your overall sentiment?
I'm quite optimistic. I think if we look back over the last 5 years, there's been a massive shift and hugely like optimistic trend line. And if we carry that forward over that period of time, I think there's a lot to be optimistic about in terms of solving some of the key challenges that we've outlined now of industrial decarbonization and carbon removal. I think there will be the next set of challenges. You know, my son is 5 now, and I think around 2040, 2050, he'll be the same age that I am now. And I guess 2050, yeah, he'll be the same age as me. And he'll have his own set of challenges. My wife is working on the methane part of this problem, which is going to be its own whole issue to deal with. So there's all kinds of issues with PFAS and like all kinds of other environmental issues. So I guess I'm optimistic that we will solve the challenges that we have dialed in on now of carbon removal, industrial decarbonization, you know, renewable grid, electric transport. Like, I think we'll solve those parts. There'll be new issues, and it'll be for them to figure out.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, Peter, thanks for doing this. This was great.
So that'll do it for the 48th episode of Cartoon Avatars and the first episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. Thank you to Peter Reinhardt for joining. Thanks to Rashad and Justin. Hope everyone has a good weekend and look forward to seeing everyone back here next week for another episode that I'll trust you'll enjoy. Have a good weekend, everyone.